methods seek to conciliate by demonstrating that it remembers the concrete too. The inadequacies of the method become manifested in its poles, the law and the example. The sociology of knowledge characterizes stubborn facts as mere differentiations and subsumes them under the highest general units. At the same time, it ascribes an intrinsic power over the facts to these arbitrary generalizations, which it calls social laws, such as the one relating cultural goods to the social status of those who produce them. The laws are hypostasized. Sometimes they assume a truly extravagant character. There is, however, a decisive law which rules us at the present moment. Unplanned spheres regulate by natural selection on the one hand and deliberately organized areas on the other can exist side by side without friction only as long as the unplanned spheres predominate. Mannheim's Italics. Page 461. Quantified propositions of this form are no more evident than those of Baderian metaphysics, over which they have the advantage only of a lack of imagination. The falseness of Mannheim's hypostasization of general concepts can be grasped precisely at the point where he interjects the principia media to which he debased the law of dialectical movement. However much we must take the principia media and the corresponding concepts, late capitalism, structural unemployment, lower middle class ideology, and so on, as concrete expressions of a special historical setting, it should nevertheless be borne in mind that what we are doing is differentiating and individualizing abstract and general determinants, general factors. The principia media are in a certain sense nothing but contemporary groups of general factors so closely intertwined that they operate as a single causal factor. That we are essentially dealing here with general factors in an historical and individual setting is evident from our example. Our first observation implies the general principle of the functioning of a social order with freely contracting legal personalities. The second, the psychological effects of unemployment in general. And the last, the general law that hopes of social advancement tend to affect individuals in a way which obscures their real social position. It is just as mistaken, Mannheim continues, to believe that conceptions of a man in general are valid in themselves as to neglect or ignore the general principles of the human psyche within the concrete modes of behavior of these historical types. Accordingly, the historical events seem to be determined in part by general, in part by particular causes, which together form some sort of group. This, however, implies the confusion of levels of abstraction with causes. Mannheim sees the decisive weakness of dialectical thought in its misunderstanding of general forces, as if the commodity forms were not general enough for all the questions with which he deals. General forces, however, are not independent in opposition to particular ones, as though a concrete event were caused once by causal proposition and then again by the specific historical situation. No event is caused by general forces, much less by laws. Causality is not the cause of events, but rather the highest conceptual generality under which concrete causal factors can be subsumed. The significance of the observation Newton made on the falling apple is not that the general law of causality acts within a complex which includes factors of a lower degree of abstraction. Causality operates only in the particular and not in addition to it. Only to this extent can the falling apple be called an example of the law of gravity. The law of gravity is as much dependent on the falling of this apple as his vice versa. Page 462. The concrete play of forces can be reduced to schemata of varying levels of generality, but it is not a question of conjunction of general and particular forces. Mannheim's pluralism of course, which conceives what is crucial as mere one perspective among many, is hardly eager to give up its sums of general and particular factors. The fact, baptized in advance as a unique situation, thereby becomes a mere example of these forces. Dialectical theory, in contrast, can no more accept the concept of the example as valid than could Kant. Examples function as convenient and interchangeable illustrations. Hence, they are often chosen at a comfortable distance from the true concerns of mankind today, or they are pulled, as it were, out of a hat. But they are quickly forced to pay the consequences. Mannheim writes, for instance, an illuminating example of the disturbances which can arise from substantial irrationality may be seen where, for example, the diplomatic staff of a state has carefully thought out a series of actions and has agreed on certain steps when suddenly one of its members falls prey to a nervous collapse and then acts contrary to the plan, thereby destroying it. It is useless to portray such private events as factors. Not only is the radius of action of the individual diplomat romantically overestimated, but also, unless the plunder itself served the course of political developments stronger than the diplomat's considerations. It could be corrected in 5 minutes over the telephone, or with the pictorial vividness of a children's book. Mannheim writes, "As a soldier, I must control my impulses and desires to a quite different degree than as a free hunter, whose acts are only periodically purposive and who will only occasionally need to take hold of himself. For instance, at the moment when he has to fire at his prey. As is generally known, the occupation of hunter has in recent years been replaced by the sport of hunting. But even the sportsman who takes hold of himself only at the moment when he has to fire at his prey, apparently in order not to be startled by the crack of his own rifle, will hardly beg much, probably frighten away his prey and perhaps not even find it. The insignificance of such examples is closely related to the influence the sociology of knowledge has had, selected for their subjective neutrality and therefore inessential in advance. The examples serve to distract. Sociology originated in the impulse to criticize the principles of the society with which it found itself confronted. The sociology of knowledge settles for reflections on hunters dressed in green and diplomats in black." Page 463. The direction in which, in terms of content, the formalism of such conceptualization tends reveals itself when programmatic demands are voiced. An optimum for the thorough organization of society is demanded, but not thought is given to the gap that would have to be bridged to attain such an optimum. If things are only put together rationally, everything will fall into place. Mannheim's ideal of a desired direction between unconscious conservatism and misdirected utopianism corresponds to this. We can see at the same time, however, the general outline of a possible solution to the present tension, namely a sort of authoritarian democracy, making use of planning and creating a stable system from the present conflict of principles. This is in accordance with the stylistic elevation of the crisis to a human problem in which Mannheim shows himself in agreement with modern German anthropologists. His declaration against them notwithstanding, and with the existentialist philosophers, two characteristics more than all others, however, reveal the conformism of Mannheim's sociology of knowledge. First, it remains concerned with symptoms. It is thoroughly disposed to overestimate the significance of ideologies as opposed to what they represent. It placidly shares with them precisely that equivocal conception of the irrational to which the critical level should be applied. We must, moreover, realize that the irrational is not always harmful, but that, on the contrary, it is among the most valuable powers in man's possession when it acts as a driving force toward rational or objective ends, creates cultural values through sublimation and cultivation, or, as pur elan, heightens the joy of living without breaking up the social order by lack of planning. There are no further hints as to the nature of this irrational, which is said to produce cultural values through cultivation. Also, such values are by definition the product of cultivation or to heighten the joy of living, which is irrational anyway. In any case, however, the equation of the instincts with the irrational is ominous, for the concept is applied in value-free manner both to the libido and to the form its repression takes. The irrational seems to endow ideologies with substantiality in Mannheim. They receive a paternal reproof, but are left intact. What they conceal is never exposed, but the vulgar materialism of prevailing praxis is closely related to this positivistic tendencies to accept symptoms uncritically, this perceptible respect for the claims of ideology. The facade remains intact in the glow of amenable observation, and the ultimate wisdom of this sociology is that no impulse could arise within the interior which could seriously threaten to proceed beyond its carefully marked bounds. In actual fact, the existing body of ideas, and the same applies to vocabulary, never exceeds the horizon and the radius of activity of the society in question. Page 464. Whatever exceeds the limits, to be sure, can easily be seen as adjustment to the emotional evocation of spiritual values and so on. This materialism, akin to that of the family head who considers it utterly impossible for his offspring to have a new thought since everything has already been thought, and hence recommends that he concentrate on earning a respectable living. This seasoned and arrogant materialism is the reverse image of the idealism in Mannheim's view of history, an idealism to which he also remains true in other respects, especially in his conception of rationality and progress, an idealism according to which changes in consciousness are even capable of lifting the structural principle of society off its hinges from the inside out, so to speak. The real attraction of the sociology of knowledge can be thought only in the fact that those changes in consciousness as achievements of planning reason are linked directly to the reasoning of today's planners. The fact that the complex actions of a functional, thoroughly rationalized society can be thought through only in the heads of a few organizers assures the latter of a key position in society. The motive, which becomes apparent here, extends beyond the consciousness of the sociology of knowledge. The objective spirit, as that of those few organizers, speaks through it, while the sociology of knowledge dreams of new academic fields to conquer. It unsuspectingly serves those who have not hesitated a moment to abolish those fields. Mannheim's reflections, nourished by liberal common